Imagine discovering that the $10,000 you just invested in your best friend's startup wasn't just a bad idea. Like, it was legally an unregistered security.
Oh, yeah, that is a nightmare scenario.
Right, and because of literally a single paperwork error, your friend is now facing total bankruptcy and the state regulators are knocking on the door. I mean, it happens way more often than you think.
It really does. People just, they don't know the rules.
Exactly. But hey, before we get into the absolute chaos of securities regulation, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com. It's awesome.
Highly recommend.
Okay, so speaking of the study trenches, that is exactly our mission today. We are doing a massive, comprehensive deep dive into the securities and issuer regulation section of the Series 65 exam.
Which is a beast of a section.
It really is. And if you listening right now, if you are looking at your exam breakdown, you might notice this section is only about 5% of your exam, which translates to roughly 7 questions.
Right, which, to a lot of people sounds like a rounding error. Like 7 questions out of 130 scored questions. The temptation to just skim the bold vocabulary words and move on is incredibly high.
Oh, do not skim this. I
Good.
literally cannot stress this enough because here is the reality of the Series 65. These 7 questions are notoriously tricky.
Yeah, they are the definition of gotcha questions.
Exactly. The exam writers aren't checking to see if you can define a word like a dictionary. They are designing scenarios to test if you actually understand the underlying mechanics of the law. Like, they want to know if you can spot the trapdoor hidden in a seemingly normal business transaction.
Right. The regulators want to verify that you understand the why behind a rule. Because, in the real world, your clients aren't going to come to you with textbook definitions.
Definitely not.
They're going to come to you with messy, complicated ideas, and you have to know how the law applies to those weird real-world scenarios.
Totally. So, to help you dominate this section, and honestly, to make sure you stay awake, we are going to do something a little different today.
Oh.
We are throwing out the textbook approach.
Thank goodness.
Right. Instead, we are going to build a universe. We are going to introduce a cast of characters that will basically live rent-free in your head while you are sitting in that exam center staring at the screen.
Giving these abstract legal concepts a face is really the best way to make them stick.
I think so too. Abstract jargon is just hard to retain, especially for an ADHD brain like mine. But a story about a guy ruining his life because he didn't file a form, that is much easier to remember.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so you listening right now, whether you're driving or walking the dog or at the gym, I want you to visualize our primary protagonist. You're going to call him Frank. Frank the founder.
Frank the founder. Love it.
Frank is highly ambitious. He's that guy from your hometown who is always, pitching you a new business idea. He is slightly chaotic, very energetic, and he has just started a company that he believes will change the world. He manufactures high-end, glow-in-the-dark socks for dogs.
Wow, a true visionary of our time.
A pioneer, really. But Frank cannot build this global dog sock empire alone. He needs capital and he needs connections. So enter our second character, Fiona the Finder.
Okay, Fiona.
Fiona doesn't work for Frank's company. She is an independent socialite, heavily connected, and she knows absolutely all the wealthy people in town.
So she's essentially the gatekeeper to the capital.
She is. Then we have our target, Ian the Investor.
Ian the investor, got it.
Ian has incredibly deep pockets.
Yeah.
Like, maybe he inherited a fortune or maybe he sold a dental practice. I don't know. But honestly, he is easily confused by financial paperwork. He just wants a good return on his money without having to do any actual work.
Which is a very common type of client, frankly.
Super common. And finally, we have Agent Annie. Annie is Frank's loyal, full-time employee. She works directly for his company in the office, answering phones and helping Frank run the day-to-day operations.
So she's on the payroll.
Yep, W-2 employee. So that's our cast: Frank the founder, Fiona the finder, Ian the investor, and Agent Annie.
It's a solid lineup. I feel like I know them already.
Perfect. And before we even get into the weeds of the regulations, I want to ask you a direct question. You listening, stop what you're doing and think about this for a second. If Frank wants to sell you a piece of his glow-in-the-dark dog sock empire, what exactly is he selling you, legally speaking?
That is the foundational question of this entire regulatory framework. Because if
Exactly.
you don't know what the thing is, you don't know what rules apply to it, you have to categorize it first.
Right. Before we can talk about how Frank registers his business or how he files his paperwork or, you know, whether he ends up in federal prison for fraud, we have to know if his dog sock stock is actually legally a security. So let's unpack this. What even is a security?
Well, if we look at the statutory definition under the Uniform Securities Act,
which is the model law that most state regulations are based on, right?
Correct. The USA. It lists all the usual suspects you would immediately expect. It says a security is a note, a stock, a treasury stock, a bond, a debenture.
The classic Wall Street stuff. Like if I say stock market, that's what pops into your head.
Right, exactly. But the list goes on. It includes things like evidence of indebtedness, collateral trust certificates, transferable shares, voting trust certificates, and warrants or rights to purchase any of those things.
Okay, that's a lot of jargon.
It is. Now, you don't necessarily need to memorize every single one of those terms in perfect isolation, but you need to recognize them as securities. But where the exam really focuses its energy is on the catch-all category.
Catch-all categories. Because Frank is chaotic. He might not call his offering a stock. He thinks the word stock sounds too boring for a glow-in-the-dark dog apparel company.
Of course he does.
He might call it a canine luminescence profit participation unit.
And that is exactly why the legal definition includes broad phrases, phrases like certificate of interest or participation in any profit-sharing agreement.
Ah, so they saw Frank coming.
They absolutely did.
Right.
The regulators knew people would try to invent new names to get around the law, but the most famous and absolutely the most testable broad category in the definition is the investment contract.
Investment contract, okay.
Yeah. And to figure out if Frank's weirdly named offering is an investment contract, we have to use something called the Howey test.
The legendary Howey test. Let's really break this down because understanding the history of this is basically guaranteed points on the exam. Where does this test even come from?
It comes from a landmark Supreme Court case from 1946, SEC v. W.J. Howey Co. It's actually a really fascinating story.
I love a good origin story. Give it to me.
So W.J. Howey was a company in Florida that owned massive tracts of citrus groves, and they would sell sections of this land, literally rows of orange trees, to out-of-state investors who were down there vacationing at their resort.
So they're basically just selling real estate.
That's exactly what Howey argued. They said, look, we are just selling deeds to land. Real estate isn't a security.
Makes sense on the surface.
Right. But here was the catch. These buyers were tourists from New York and Chicago. They didn't know anything about farming oranges, and they lived thousands of miles away.
Right. They aren't going down there to pick oranges.
Exactly. So Howey conveniently offered them a service contract alongside the land deed. Howey's own crews would cultivate the land, harvest the oranges, sell them on the market, and then just, you know, mail a check with the profits back to the investor up north.
Oh, wow. Okay, so the investor is literally just writing a check and going back to Chicago to wait for money.
Bingo. So the SEC stepped in and said, hold on. You aren't selling real estate. You are selling unregistered securities.
And Howey fought it.
They fought it all the way to the Supreme Court. Mm. And the Supreme Court sided with the SEC, and in doing so, they established the principle of substance over form.
Substance over form. Meaning what it actually does is more important than what it's called.
Precisely. It doesn't matter if the piece of paper says land deed. What matters is the economic reality of the transaction. And from that case, the court created a four-prong test to determine if something is an investment contract.
Okay, this is huge. Let's run Frank's dog sock business through those four prongs. And you, listening right now, try to guess them before we reveal them. What is prong number one of the Howey test?
Prong one is simply an investment of money.
Easy enough. So if Ian the investor writes Frank a check for $1,000, boom, we've hit prong one. Money has changed hands.
Yep. Prong two is in a common enterprise.
In a common enterprise. I always think of this as pooling. Like, Ian isn't just buying something for himself in a vacuum. His money is pooling together with Frank's business capital, or maybe with, like, other investors' money.
Right. Their financial fates are linked together.
Yeah. If the dog sock business takes off, they all win. If it crashes, they all lose together.
That's the perfect way to look at it. Now, prong three is with the expectation of profits.
Expectation of profits. This basically separates an investment from a donation. Or just a normal consumer purchase.
Exactly.
Ian didn't give Frank $1,000 out of the goodness of his heart. He's not donating to a charity. He expects a financial return.
Right. And finally, we have prong four. And honestly, This is the crucial one that defines the whole concept.
Okay, what is it?
The expectation of profits must be derived solely from the efforts of others.
Solely from the efforts of others.
Yeah.
Let's do a ridiculous analogy to make this stick for the listener. Let's say you go to Frank's website right now, and you literally just buy a pair of glow-in-the-dark dog socks for $20. You hand over money. Is that a security?
No, absolutely not. Because you fail prong 3 and prong 4. You are buying a consumer product.
Right.
You don't expect to make a profit from those socks, and you certainly aren't relying on Frank's managerial efforts to generate a return for you. You just want your dog's feet to glow.
Exactly. But what if Frank comes to you and says, listen, give me $1,000. I'm going to buy a new factory. I'm going to hire the workers. I'm going to manufacture the socks, market them, and sell them across Europe. You just sit on your couch, watch TV, and I will send you 10% of the net profits every single quarter.
Boom! You just hit all 4 prongs perfectly.
And to review them.
You invested money, which is prong 1. In a common enterprise with Frank, prong 2. You are expecting a profit, prong 3. And here is the key. You are sitting on your couch.
I am doing absolutely nothing.
Right. The profit is derived solely from the managerial and entrepreneurial efforts of Frank and his team, which is prong 4. That makes it an investment contract. Therefore, legally, it is a security.
I love that.
Yeah.
So when you are taking the exam, look at the scenario they give you and just ask yourself, who is doing the heavy lifting here? If the investors pass it, like if they're just providing the capital and hoping the promoter does a good job, it's almost certainly a security.
The exam writers love to dress this up too. They might use earthworms, they might use payphones, they might use whiskey casks. It literally doesn't matter what the underlying asset is. Just apply the 4 prongs of Howie.
Okay, that makes so much sense. Now let's talk about the exact opposite. Because as much as the exam wants you to know what a security is, they absolutely love to test what is not a security.
Oh, they love the exclusions.
The exclusions. These are the trapdoors, right? Things that sound like investments. They kind of act like investments. But legally, they are specifically excluded from the definition.
Right. And you have to know them cold.
So let's talk about the biggest, most consistent exam trap of them all. Annuities. We have fixed annuities and we have variable annuities. One is a security, one is not. Break down the mechanical why for us, because just memorizing the rule isn't going to help when they throw a weird scenario at you.
The distinction here is entirely about who is holding the risk.
Okay, who is holding the risk?
Let's look at a fixed annuity, or honestly, even a traditional whole life insurance policy. When Ian, the investor, buys a fixed annuity, the insurance company is making a contractual promise to pay him a fixed sum of money.
A guaranteed amount.
Right. Let's say $2,000 a month for the rest of his life, regardless of what the stock market does, regardless of interest rates, regardless of inflation.
So if the S&P 500 drops 40% tomorrow, Ian still gets his $2,000 on the first of the month.
Yes. The insurance company takes all the investment risk. They take Ian's money, they put it in their general account, and they invest it in conservative bonds and mortgages.
So it's their problem if the market tanks.
Exactly. If their investments perform terribly, it's the insurance company's problem, not Ian's. They still legally have to pay him. Because of that guarantee, because the risk is entirely on the institution, a fixed annuity is classified purely as an insurance product. It is legally excluded from the definition of a security.
Okay, I understand the mechanism there. The institution takes the hit. But what happens if Ian goes to his broker and buys a variable annuity?
The entire risk profile shifts. In a variable annuity, Ian's money does not go into the insurance company's general account.
Where does it go?
It goes into a separate, segregated account, which is typically invested in a menu of mutual funds, you know, equities, growth stocks, things like that. So Ian's monthly payout depends entirely on the investment results of those underlying funds.
Oh, I see. So if the market crashes 40%,
Ian's payout crashes right along with it. The risk has been transferred directly to the investor. And because the returns depend on market performance and the investor bears the risk, a variable annuity, i.e., a security.
So to summarize that trap for the listener, fixed means the insurance company is the one sweating, not a security. Variable means the investor is sweating. It is a security.
That's a great mental shortcut. If the investor bears the investment risk, it falls under securities regulation.
Let's look at another major gotcha in the definition section. It involves a phrase that trips up so many test takers. Certificate of deposit.
A classic misdirection by the test writers.
Let's say Ian walks into his local brick and mortar bank, hands the teller $10,000, and gets a standard certificate of deposit, a CD, that pays 5% interest for a 12-month term. Is that a security?
No, it's not. A standard bank CD is a deposit product. You are placing money with the bank, earning a fixed rate of interest, and it is insured by the FDIC. It is regulated under banking laws, not securities laws.
I get that. But, and this is a big but, if you read the actual statutory definition of a security in the Uniform Securities Act, which we touched on earlier, one of the items literally listed in the definition is a certificate of deposit for a security. It uses the exact same first three words.
It does, and that is exactly why people miss the question. A certificate of deposit for a security is a completely different financial instrument. It's usually referring to something called an American Depositary Receipt, or an ADR.
Okay, I want to break down the mechanics of an ADR because I feel like it demystifies the weird name. Let's say I want to invest in a massive Japanese company, like Toyota.
Well, if you wanted to buy actual shares of Toyota, you would have to convert your US dollars to Japanese yen. You'd have to open a brokerage account that has access to the Tokyo Stock Exchange, execute the trade during Japanese market hours, and then deal with all the foreign tax withholdings.
That sounds like a massive headache for a retail investor.
It's a huge barrier to entry. So what does Wall Street do to fix that? A major U.S. bank, like JP Morgan or Citibank, will go to Tokyo, buy 10 million shares of Toyota, and literally lock them in a vault.
Okay, they have the shares.
Then that U.S. bank will issue receipts here in the United States that represent ownership of those shares in the vault. Those receipts are ADRs. They trade on the New York Stock Exchange in U.S. dollars, they pay dividends in U.S. dollars, and they trade during normal U.S. market hours.
So the U.S. bank is issuing a certificate to me showing that I have a deposit of a security in their vault.
Precisely. Because the underlying asset inside that vault is a stock, the certificate itself is the security.
So you, listening on your commute right now, underline this in your mental notebook. Banked CD equals a banking product. Not a security. Certificate of deposit 4R, a security, like an ADR, equals way S, a security.
Do not let them catch you on that phreezing. Always read the whole sentence in the multiple choice option.
All right, let's keep the narrative moving. We've established that Frank's Canine Luminescence Profit Participation Unit is, in fact, an investment contract under Howie, and therefore a security. Now we need to talk about who exactly Frank is in the eyes of the law.
We need to define the term issuer.
Right. Under the Uniform Securities Act, Frank, the founder, is the issuer. The logic is pretty simple. He is the person who issues or proposes to issue the security. He is the genesis of the stock. He created it.
And, I mean, in 99% of cases, it is very straightforward. The corporation, the municipality, or the government entity creating the stock or bond is the issuer.
Yeah.
But, as always, with this exam, you aren't tested on the 99%. You are tested on the weird exceptions.
Get me with the weird exceptions. I want to know them.
Let's go back to those ADRs we just discussed. Or things like voting trust certificates or collateral trust certificates. For those specific instruments, the issuer is legally defined as the person performing the acts of depositor or manager.
Okay, so it's the U.S. bank managing the ADR program, not Toyota itself.
Exactly right.
Okay, that makes mechanical sense. But let me throw a huge pattern interrupt at you. Let's say Frank realizes that dog socks are a fad, and he pivots. He decides he's going to drill for oil in his backyard.
Classic Frank.
He starts selling fractional interests in his new oil lease to his neighbors. He issues a certificate of participation in this oil and gas venture. Who is the issuer?
This is one of the strangest rules in the entire Uniform Securities Act. For certificates of interest or participation in oil, gas, or mining titles or leases, there is no issuer.
Wait, none? Like it's just a legal ghost town? How is that even possible?
It is a complete ghost town. The statute explicitly states they have no identifiable issuer.
Make it make sense.
Why? To understand why, you kind of have to look at the history of wildcatting. Back in the day, an independent prospector might lease land, divide that lease into, 64 microscopic fractions, and sell them off to locals to fund the drill.
Okay.
There was no formal corporation, no board of directors, just a guy with a drill and a handshake. The lawmakers realized it was impossible to regulate these wildcatters under standard corporate issuer rules, so they just carved them out entirely.
That is wild. So if the exam asks who the issuer of an oil and gas certificate is, the answer is literally no one, or there is no issuer.
Exactly. It's a specific trivia point you just have to memorize. Oil, gas, mining equals no issuer.
Okay, let's pivot to how these securities are actually traded. The exam will heavily test your ability to distinguish between an issuer transaction and a non-issuer transaction.
And this entire concept hinges on what we call the who gets the money rule. If you follow the money, you will always get this question right.
Okay, let's apply the who gets the money rule to a scenario. Frank's company is doing incredibly well. He decides to take the company public with an initial public offering, an IPO.
Good for Frank.
They sell 1 million shares to the market at $10 a share. $10 million flows directly into Frank's company treasury, which he uses to buy a new manufacturing plant, and 10 tons of glow-in-the-dark dye.
Because the proceeds of the sale went directly to the issuer, meaning to Frank's corporate entity, that is an issuer transaction.
Okay.
It's directly for the benefit of the issuer. This is what we call the primary market. The securities are being created and sold for the first time, and the company gets the cash.
Okay. Scenario two. A year later, Ian, the investor who bought some of those IPO shares, decides he is tired of tracking the dog apparel industry. He wants to buy a sports car.
Naturally.
So he calls his broker, sells his shares on the open market, and pockets the cash.
Did Frank's company get any of that money?
No. Frank's company didn't see a single dime of that. Ian got it all.
Then it is a non-issuer transaction. It is a secondary market sale. The defining characteristic of the secondary market is that the issuer does not receive the proceeds. The transaction is just between two investors.
All right, you listening right now, here's a hypothetical exam trap. Stop and think about this one carefully. What if Frank, who is the CEO, the founder, and the face of the company, decides to sell some of his personal stash of founder's shares?
Ooh, good one.
He has owned them for 5 years. He sells them on the open market, and he takes that cash and uses it to buy himself a brand new personal yacht. Is that an issuer transaction? Because Frank is literally the founder of the issuer.
It is a fantastic trap, and a lot of people fall for it. But the answer is absolutely no. That is a non-issuer transaction.
I can see someone arguing, but Frank IS the company. Explain why the law disagrees.
Because legally, you have to separate Frank, the individual human being, from Frank's Doc Socks, Inc., the corporate entity. The proceeds from that stock sale did not go into the corporate treasury. The money didn't buy more dye or pay the factory workers. The money went to Frank's personal bank account to buy a yacht. Because the issuer, meaning the corporation, did not benefit from the sale, it is a non-issuer transaction.
Okay, so the who gets the money rule really never fails. If the corporation gets the cash, it's an issuer transaction. If anyone else gets the cash, even the CEO selling his own personal stock, it's non-issuer.
Stick to that rule and you won't get tricked.
Now, before we move into the actual hustle of selling these securities, I want to take a slight detour to introduce a memory aid for the federal regulations that hover over all of this. Because the Series 65 loves to test the difference between the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934.
Oh, they love to mix these two up in the multiple choice options. They will describe a rule and ask which act it comes from.
So annoying. But the way to remember the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 is the acronym SCAM, S-C-A-M. Think of it this way. The 1929 stock market crash was full of horrific scams. So in 1934, the government passed a law to stop the scams.
I like that. Let's break down the letters. The S stands for SEC creation. The 1934 Act is what actually created the Securities and Exchange Commission to act as the watchdog. It also gave the Federal Reserve Board, the FRB, authority over margins.
Right. S is SEC and FRB. What's the C?
C is for credit regulation. This ties directly into the margin rules, specifically Regulation T, which dictates how much credit broker-dealers can extend to customers to buy stock.
Because excessive margin borrowing caused the 29 crash.
Exactly. So they clamped down on the credit. Then A is for anti-fraud. Specifically, the broad federal anti-fraud rules that apply to the secondary market.
And M is for anti-manipulation. This is a huge one. It covers all the illegal secondary market manipulation tactics that insiders used to fleece retail investors. Things like wash trades, matched orders, and painting the tape. Let's actually pause and explain those because they sound like jargon. What is a wash trade, mechanically speaking?
A wash trade is when a trader simultaneously buys and sells the exact same stock through two different brokers. Let's say I put in an order to buy 1,000 shares of Apple at $150 at Charles Schwab, and I simultaneously put in an order to sell them 1,000 shares of Apple at $150 at E-Trade.
Wait, why would you do that?
Because my ownership doesn't change. My net money doesn't change. But to the rest of the market, it looks like there is a sudden burst of trading volume on Apple stock.
Ooh. Which tricks other investors or, you know, algorithmic trading bots today into thinking, oh, something big is happening with Apple. I better buy in. It creates fake momentum.
Exactly. Matched orders are essentially the same thing, but it involves two colluding individuals instead of one person with two accounts. Trader A and Trader B constantly trade back and forth to each other to fake volume.
Gotcha.
This is also called painting the tape, referring to the old ticker tape machines. The 1934 Act made all of this highly illegal.
So scam, S-C-A-M. If a question asks you about the SEC being created, or margin rules, or secondary market manipulation, you immediately think 34 Act.
Right. And you contrast that with the Securities Act of 1933. The 33 Act has absolutely nothing to do with secondary market trading or scam.
What is it about?
The 33 Act is entirely about new issues. It's about requiring registration and prospectuses for brand new securities being offered to the public for the very first time. It's the Primary Market Act.
I always call it the Paper Act.
Yep.
33 is the Paper Act, you know, new issues, prospectuses, raising initial capital.
Yeah.
34 is scam, the people, the secondary market, the watchdogs.
It is a very clean way to keep them separate in your mind during the stress of the exam.
Okay, let's transition back to Frank. We know what a security is. We know Frank is the issuer. Now, Frank wants to actually sell his stock to raise capital. But Frank is a visionary. He's busy designing the next generation of neon dog apparel.
He doesn't have time to sell.
Right.
Yay.
He can't sit on the phone all day pitching investors. He needs help. So he enlists Agent Annie, who is a full-time employee at his company, and Fiona the Finder, who is that independent socialite networker. Welcome to the hustle.
And this is where the regulatory nightmare really begins if they don't do things exactly by the book.
Let's start with Agent Annie. Annie is an employee. She receives a salary. She represents Frank, the issuer, in trying to sell this stock. Does Annie need to register as an agent with the state administrator?
The default answer under the Uniform Securities Act is a resounding yes. Anyone who represents an issuer in affecting securities transactions must register as an agent. That is the baseline rule.
Okay, baseline rule is yes.
Right, unless they hit a very specific statutory exclusion.
Okay, so the state assumes she must register, unless she can prove she fits in a safe harbor. Let's look at the unless list. What are the exclusions from agent registration for someone representing an issuer?
There are four main exclusions you really need to know. First, if Annie is affecting transactions in exempt securities, we will go over the full list later, but this means things like U.S. government bonds, Canadian government bonds, bank securities, or top-rated commercial paper.
So if Frank's company was somehow the U.S. government selling treasury bills, Annie wouldn't need to register to sell them.
Exactly.
But Frank sells dog socks, not U.S. treasury bonds. So that first exclusion is out. What's the second one?
Second, if Annie is affecting exempt transactions, again, we'll deep dive into these, but this includes things like isolated non-issuer transactions or sales exclusively to sophisticated institutional buyers. If Annie's only job is to sell Frank's stock to Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, she doesn't need to register.
Because the state doesn't feel the need to protect Wall Street banks from Annie.
Right, they can take care of themselves.
Okay, what's the third exclusion?
Third, if she is affecting transactions in certain federal covered securities, specifically those sold to qualified purchasers or sold under the Regulation D private placement exemption.
All right, and the fourth one, because I know this is the one that gets heavily tested.
The fourth exclusion applies if Annie is affecting transactions with existing employees, partners, or directors of the issuer, AND, and this is the crucial hinge, no commission or other remuneration is paid for soliciting those specific sales.
Okay, you listening, stop whatever you're doing. Put your exam hat on. Here is a massive gotcha question. Let's say Frank tells Annie, look, I need you to sell our stock to the general public. Go stand on Main Street and pitch it to retail investors. But don't worry about registering with the state because I'm not going to pay you a commission. I'm just going to pay you your normal flat salary of $60,000 a year. Does Annie have to register?
Oh, I see people get this wrong all the time. No, no, PE. She absolutely must register.
I can hear the listener arguing, but he didn't pay her a commission. The rule says no commission. Explain why she has to register.
Because you have to read both halves of the rule. The no commission exclusion only applies if she is selling the stock to existing employees, partners, or directors of the company. It is an internal carve out for things like employee stock purchase plans.
Right.
It absolutely does not apply to selling to the general public. If an issuer's employee is selling the company's stock to the public in a non-exempt transaction, they must register as an agent, period. Whether they get a commission, a salary, or a high five is totally irrelevant if it's sold to the public.
It's such a good trap. The regulators understand that if you are offering stock internally to your coworkers as part of a benefits package, it's not high-pressure sales. But if you turn your employee into a public-facing salesperson, they need to be licensed.
Exactly. You can't just bypass the law by paying a salary instead of a commission if they are dealing with the public.
Okay, that's Agent Annie. She's internal. Now let's talk about Fiona the Finder. Fiona is not an employee. She is an independent operator. She goes to country clubs and charity galas. She introduces Frank to wealthy investors like Ian. And obviously she wants a cut of the action for making the introduction. What is the regulatory framework for finders?
The rules for finders are incredibly strict, and they revolve around two things: what Fiona is actually doing and how she is getting compensated.
Okay.
If a finder literally just hands Frank a list of names and gets paid a flat fee for that list, they might avoid registration. But if Fiona's activities go beyond mere introductions, like if she starts pitching the business, negotiating deal terms, answering financial questions, or, you know, handling the investment funds, she has crossed a massive legal line. She is now acting as an unregistered broker dealer.
But let's say she just makes introductions. What is the absolute kiss of death for a finder? What triggers the registration requirement almost every single time, regardless of how limited her role was?
Transaction-based compensation.
I mean, a percentage of the deal.
Exactly. If Fiona says, "Hey, Frank, I'll introduce you to Ian, but I want 5% of whatever Ian ultimately invests," that is transaction-based compensation. Regulators view a percentage fee as a massive conflict of interest.
Because it incentivizes her to close the deal.
Right. It is an inherent incentive for Fiona to actively push the sale. She is no longer just a neutral party introducing two people. She is financially motivated to ensure that transaction closes so she can get her commission. That makes her a broker.
So transaction-based compensation equals almost always required to register as a broker dealer.
Yes. A flat fee, like pay me $5,000 right now for this list of 10 names, regardless of whether they invest, is much safer, though regulators still scrutinize it. But a percentage fee is a blaring red siren.
Okay, direct question to you, the listener. Think about this carefully. Let's say Frank is desperate. He uses Fiona. She brings in Ian. Ian invests 100 grand. And Frank pays Fiona a $5,000 commission, so 5%. Fiona is not registered as a broker dealer. What is Frank's biggest risk here? Is Frank going to jail? Are the FBI going to kick down the door of the dog sock factory?
This is a huge exam concept because people assume the most dramatic punishment. No, Frank doesn't automatically go to jail. Criminal liability generally requires willful, intentional fraud. Frank might have just been ignorant of the rules regarding finders.
Okay, so does Frank have to register as a broker dealer himself?
No, that is Fiona's problem. Fiona is the one breaking the law by acting as an unregistered broker dealer.
So what is the actual risk to Frank, the issuer, for using her?
The risk is civil, and it is absolutely catastrophic to the business. By using an unregistered finder who is acting as a broker, Frank taints the entire offering. He loses his offering exemption.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Let's say he was relying on a private placement exemption to avoid spending hundreds of thousands of dollars registering his stock with the SEC. Because he used an illegal finder, that exemption is now blown. His offering is retroactively deemed an illegal, unregistered offering.
Oh, man. And what is the nightmare consequence of blowing that exemption?
Rescission rights.
I want that to echo in the listener's head. Rescission rights. Explain what that means mechanically.
If the exemption is blown, every single investor in the entire offering, not just the ones Fiona found, but every single person who bought stock gets rescission rights. This means they have the legal right to force Frank to buy the stock back.
Wow.
They can demand a return of their original principal investment, plus statutory interest, which is often around 6%, plus attorney's fees, minus any dividends they already received.
So let's play this out. A year goes by. The dog sock business is struggling. Glow-in-the-dark apparel isn't as popular as Frank thought. The stock is basically worthless. Ian, the investor, is mad. He talks to his lawyer, and the lawyer realizes Frank used an unregistered finder. So Ian can go to Frank and say, "Hey, Frank, you messed up the exemption. Give me my $100,000 back plus 6% interest." But Frank has already spent that money on the factory. Frank has to liquidate the company to pay Ian back. Frank's empire goes bankrupt overnight.
Exactly. The risk to the issuer is loss of the offering exemption and triggering rescission rights across the whole offering. When you see a question about an issuer using an unregistered finder, scan the answers for rescission rights. It is the ultimate civil penalty.
That is brilliant. Okay, so to avoid ending up like Frank in our last scenario, where he's bankrupt and crying into a pile of neon socks, let's talk about doing things by the book. Let's talk about the registration maze.
Right. If your security is not exempt, you have to register it with the state administrator before you can legally offer or sell it in that state.
Under the Uniform Securities Act, it is unlawful to offer or sell any security in a state unless one of three things is true. What are they?
One, the security is formally registered under the USA. Two, the security or the specific transaction qualifies for an exemption. Or three, it is a federal covered security.
Okay, let's assume Frank has no exemptions and has to do the grueling work of state registration. There are three methods of state registration. Let's do a side-by-side comparison. First method, registration by filing. It's also known as notification in some states. Who gets to use this?
This is the easiest method, but it is reserved for the big, established, seasoned companies. To use filing, the issuer must meet very strict criteria. They must have been in continuous business in the U.S. for at least 36 months. They must have a class of equity securities registered under the 34 Act, held by 500 or more people, and they must meet strict financial benchmarks, like a total net worth of $4 million.
Why are the rules so strict for this method?
Because filing is essentially just a notification. You are just telling the state, hey, we are issuing more stock. The state administrator doesn't need to do a deep, rigorous investigation because this company is already massive, publicly traded, and heavily scrutinized by the SEC.
So Frank's startup DarkSock company is definitely not using filing. It's for established titans. How does the effective date work for filing?
It's tied to their federal SEC registration. If the state filing has been on file for at least 5 business days and the required fee is paid, the state registration automatically becomes effective at the exact same moment the federal registration becomes effective.
Okay, second method, registration by coordination. I know this is the most common one.
Yes. This is the standard method for initial public offerings, or IPOs, for companies that are going public for the first time. It is coordinated simultaneously with the SEC under the Securities Act of 33. You literally take copies of the prospectus you filed with the federal government and you submit them to the state administrator.
And what about the effective date for coordination?
Just like filing, it becomes effective when the federal registration becomes effective, but UT, the timeline is longer. The state filing must have been on file for at least 10 days, and maximum and minimum proposed offering prices must be on file for 2 full business days.
Let's explore the why there. Why does coordination take 10 days while filing only takes 5?
Because an IPO company doesn't have a 36-month public track record. The state administrator needs more time to review the prospectus and ensure there are no glaring red flags before they let it go live to retail investors in their state.
Okay, here's a gotcha. What if the SEC moves really fast? The SEC says, you're effective, but the state paperwork has only been on file in Kansas for 8 days.
Then the state registration in Kansas is not effective yet. It will become effective the moment all state conditions are met, which would be 2 days later when the 10-day clock runs out.
Good to know. Finally, the third method, registration by qualification.
This is the most difficult do-it-yourself method. It is entirely intrastate, meaning it's just for an offering taking place within one single state. There is absolutely no SEC involvement.
So the state is doing all the work.
Exactly. Because the feds aren't looking at it, the state administrator requires massive amounts of disclosure. Officer background info, detailed use of proceeds, audited financial statements, legal opinions, even a physical specimen of the security itself.
And here is the massive gotcha for qualification. When does it become effective?
Only when the state administrator affirmatively says so.
It is entirely at the administrator's discretion. There is no automatic trigger based on a 5-day or 10-day clock, and there is no federal filing to tie it to. The administrator reviews the mountain of paperwork, and whenever they are satisfied, they issue an order saying, you are effective today.
That is a highly testable distinction. Qualification is the Wild West. The administrator holds all the keys.
Now, regardless of whether you use filing, coordination, or qualification, how long does the registration of that security last?
A security registration is effective for 1 year from its effective date. I want to stress that. From its effective date, not the filing date.
And you, listening, do not confuse this with broker-dealer or investment advisor registrations. People mix these up constantly. Professional registrations, meaning your license to practice, expire every year on December 31st, regardless of when you got them. But a security registration lasts for 1 full year from when it became effective. If Frank's stock goes effective on May 15th, it is registered until May 15th of the next year.
That is an excellent point of clarification to keep straight for the exam.
Okay, let's talk about the magic words that allow you to skip state registration entirely. Exemptions and exclusions. What is the critical legal difference between these two terms? Because, you know, to a layperson, they sound completely identical.
They do. But from a legal standpoint, they are worlds apart. An exclusion means the item does not meet the definition of a security at all. It was never subject to the rules in the first place.
Like our fixed annuity example from earlier. It's excluded. It's just an insurance contract. The securities administrator has zero jurisdiction over it.
Exactly. An exemption, on the other hand, means the item absolutely is a security. It meets the Howey test. It falls under the definition. But lawmakers have decided, for policy reasons, to release it from the rigorous registration requirements.
And here's the kicker. If you claim an exemption, who has the burden of proof?
The person claiming it. If Frank says, my offering is exempt from registration, the administrator doesn't have to prove it isn't. The burden shifts to Frank to prove that it is exempt.
So let's talk about the biggest, most powerful exemption of all, that you can't touch this rule, federal covered securities.
This comes from a pivotal 1996 law called the National Securities Markets Improvement Act, or NSMIA.
NSMIA.
Yep. In the 90s, during the tech boom, companies were complaining that trying to register a national stock offering in 50 different states with 50 different rule books was stifling commerce. So Congress passed NSMIA, which created a category called federal covered securities, and it explicitly preempted state registration.
Meaning the states are locked out.
Right. If a security is federal covered, states cannot require it to be registered, qualified, or subject to their merit review. The federal government has taken exclusive jurisdiction.
But the states didn't just roll over completely. They lost their regulatory power. They still wanted their money. What can the states ask for?
States can require a notice filing. This is not a registration. This is just the state saying, hey, we acknowledge we can't regulate you, but send us copies of the documents you filed with the SEC, give us a consent to service of process in case we need to sue you for fraud, and oh yeah, pay us our filing fee.
It is always about the fee. Now, here is a fascinating exam trap regarding that notice filing fee. Let's say two different entities forget to pay their fee to the state of Texas. Entity A is a massive mutual fund, which is a federal covered security. Entity B is Apple, which trades on the NASDAQ, so its stock is also a federal covered security. If both of them forget to pay the fee, what can the state administrator do?
This is such a specific, tricky statutory rule. If the mutual fund, an investment company, forgets to pay the fee, the administrator actually has the power to issue a stop order and suspend the offering in that state until the fee is paid.
Wow. Okay, what about Apple?
If an exchange-listed company like Apple forgets to pay, the administrator cannot issue a stop order. The Uniform Securities Act explicitly excludes exchange-listed securities from that specific enforcement tool. The state's only recourse is to take Apple to civil court to collect the fee.
So mutual funds can get hit with a stop order for missing a fee. Exchange-listed companies cannot. That is a brilliant piece of trivia that shows up on exams.
Let's look at the actual list of what else is exempt from state registration. The law divides these into two distinct buckets: exempt securities and exempt transactions.
And the distinction is crucial. An exempt security is exempt based on what it is, usually derived from the identity of the issuer. An exempt transaction is exempt based on how it is sold. The security itself might normally need registration, but because of the specific way the trade occurred, it's exempt. Let's blast through some exempt securities first.
The big ones are government securities, U.S. government treasury bonds, state municipal bonds, or local agency debt. Then you have Canadian governments or foreign governments. As long as the U.S. currently maintains diplomatic relations with them, bank securities are also exempt.
Notice a pattern here. A lot of these are highly regulated entities anyway, banks, governments, municipalities.
Exactly. The legislative logic is that these entities are already scrutinized enough by other agencies, so they don't need redundant state securities registration. You also have savings institutions, federal credit unions, and heavily regulated public utilities and railroads.
What about nonprofits?
Yes. Securities of organizations operated exclusively for religious, educational, charitable, or social purposes are exempt securities.
And short-term commercial paper. Let's hit the specifics on this one because the exam loves the numbers associated with it.
For commercial paper, which is basically a short-term corporate IOU, to be an exempt security, it must have a maturity of 9 months or less.
So 270 days maximum.
Right. It must be issued in minimum denominations of at least $50,000, and it must be rated in one of the top three categories by a recognized rating agency like Moody's or S&P.
Let's think about the why here. Why 9 months? Because historically, the SEC viewed anything under 270 days as short-term working capital to fund operations, not a long-term investment that requires a massive prospectus. Why a $50K minimum and top ratings? Because this isn't designed for average retail investors. This is for massive corporations lending cash to each other overnight. The regulators don't feel the need to protect institutional players with full registration as long as it's highly rated and short-term.
Precisely. Now let's look at the other side of the coin. Exempt transactions. This is entirely about the circumstances of the sale.
We mentioned the isolated non-issuer transaction earlier. That's Ian selling his shares to his neighbor for a sports car. What are some other exempt transactions?
Unsolicited brokerage transactions are a big one. Let's say Ian calls up his broker out of the blue and says, buy me 100 shares of Frank's crazy dog sock company. The broker didn't recommend it, didn't pitch it. That transaction is exempt. The administrator might ask the broker to get a written acknowledgement from Ian proving that it was unsolicited.
But what if the broker called Ian and said, hey, Ian, you should really buy Frank's stock. It's going to the moon.
Then the trade is solicited. And if it's solicited, it is not an exempt transaction.
Huge difference. Oh, transactions with institutional buyers are exempt. Sales to banks, insurance companies, pension trusts.
Again, the logic is they can fend for themselves. They have armies of lawyers. They don't need the state administrator's protection.
Now, I have a direct question for the listener on the absolute most tested exempt transaction, the limited offering exemption. Listen carefully to this scenario. Frank offers his stock to 10 retail investors, his buddies from college. He also offers it to 12 institutional buyers, like big investment banks. Did Frank violate the limited offering exemption, which explicitly limits you to a maximum of 10 persons?
Think about the rules we just discussed regarding institutional investors.
The answer is no. Frank did not violate the exemption. Why? Two massive reasons. First, the limit of 10 persons explicitly excludes institutional buyers. You can offer to 1,000 banks and it doesn't count against your 10-person limit. Second, the rule counts offerees, not purchasers.
That is the ultimate gotcha. The exemption is for offers directed to no more than 10 retail persons in a single state during any 12 consecutive months. Furthermore, they must be purchasing for investment purposes, not just to quickly flip it, and absolutely no commission can be paid for soliciting those retail buyers.
So Frank offering to 10 retail guys and 12 banks is perfectly fine. He hasn't crossed the line.
Let's hit one more exempt transaction. Pre-organization certificates. This is for when a company is just forming before it even officially exists, and the founders are gathering subscribers to ensure they have enough backing. You can have a maximum of 10 subscribers, and again, no commissions can be paid. But here's the critical part. No payment can be made by any subscriber.
So they just sign a piece of paper saying, I promise to buy this stock when you actually form the company and get things rolling.
Exactly. It's a pledge. If Ian signs a pre-organization certificate and hands Frank a $20 bill as a deposit, the exemption is instantly blown. No payment allowed whatsoever.
Okay, take a breath. That was a lot of state-level rules. But Frank realizes dealing with state administrators is exhausting. He wants to bypass the states entirely using federal rules. We are moving into Section 5. I want to aggressively ring an imaginary bell right now. Attention. Stop the treadmill. Pull the car over. This is the most easily confused part of the entire exam. We are doing a deep side-by-side comparison of the heavy hitters, Regulation D versus Regulation A.
These are federal exemptions under the Securities Act of 1933 that Frank can use to bypass full SEC registration. But because there are different tiers within each rule, the exam loves to test if you know which ones preempt state law, meaning they're federal covered, and which ones leave Frank at the mercy of the state administrator.
Let's start with Regulation D, which governs private placements. There are three specific flavors of Reg D we care about. Flavor number one, Rule 504, the small issue exemption. This allows Frank to raise up to $10 million in a 12-month period. He can sell to an unlimited number of accredited and non-accredited investors. Here's the million-dollar question. Is the Reg D Rule 504 small issue exemption a federal covered security?
And no, it is not federal covered. Meaning, even though Frank successfully followed the SEC's federal Reg D small issue rule, he still has to deal with state registration. The state can require him to fully register the offering under state blue sky laws.
Okay, flavor number two, Rule 506B, the traditional private placement.
This one is much more powerful. It allows Frank to raise an unlimited amount of money, but he is restricted to a maximum of 35 non-accredited but financially sophisticated investors. He can have an unlimited number of accredited investors, the wealthy ones. But crucially, he cannot use any general solicitation. He can't advertise it on a billboard or a podcast. Is this federal covered?
Yes. The traditional 506B private placement, IS, a federal covered security. The states cannot touch it other than asking for that basic notice filing and their fee.
Flavor number three. Rule 506C, the verified accredited private placement.
This one is wild. Unlimited money. In general solicitation, IS allowed. Frank can put up billboards for his dog socks. He can run Facebook ads. But the catch is intense. Zero non-accredited investors are allowed. Every single buyer must be a verified accredited investor. And Frank can't just take their word for it. He has to take reasonable steps to verify their wealth, like checking tax returns or getting a letter from their CPA. Is this one federal covered?
Yes, it is federal covered.
Okay, let's jump over to Regulation A. This is sometimes called a mini IPO because you actually have to file a document called an offering circular, a Form 1A, with the SEC. It has two tiers. Tier 1 allows you to raise up to $20 million. You don't need audited financials. Is Tier 1 federal covered?
And no. Tier 1 of Regi A is not federal covered. It is fully subject to state registration.
What about Tier 2? You can raise up to $75 million. You do need audited financials, and you have to file ongoing reports with the SEC. Is Tier 2 federal covered?
Yes. Reg 8, Tier 2 preempts state registration. It is federal covered.
Okay, I know you love connecting the dots on this stuff. What is the meta pattern here? How can a listener remember which ones are covered and which ones aren't without resorting to just blindly memorizing numbers?
If you look at the underlying logic, it's entirely about the size of the offering and the level of SEC scrutiny. The SEC is essentially saying to the states, if it's a relatively small amount of money with very little federal oversight, we are going to step back and let you states handle the regulation to protect your local citizens.
Let me test that logic. Reg D rule, 504 small issue, only $10 million. Not federal covered. States regulate it. Reg E tier 1, only $20 million. And no audited financials required, not federal covered. States regulate it.
Exactly. But when the dollar amounts get massive or the federal rules get extremely strict, the SEC preempts the states. Traditional Reg D 506B is unlimited money. Verified Reg D 506C is unlimited money. Reg Tier 2 is up to $75 million with strict audited financials. For the big money and the strict SEC filings, it is federal covered, and the states are pushed aside. Big money equals federal preemption. Small money equals state regulation.
That is a phenomenal way to remember it. Big money, the SEC takes over. Small money, the SEC leaves it to the state administrators. All right, we are entering the final section of our deep dive, the long arm of the law, anti-fraud and enforcement. Let's return to Frank one last time. Let's say Frank gets desperate. The dog socks aren't selling. The IPO failed. Fiona is demanding money. So he starts lying. He starts telling investors that dogs who wear his socks live 10 years longer because the neon dye cures canine arthritis.
A classic, egregious material misstatement.
Welcome to anti-fraud. I'm going to state the golden rule of securities regulation, and I'm going to say it three times so it burns into your brain. Fraud is never exempt. Fraud is never exempt. Fraud is never exempt.
It is the single most absolute rule in the entire Uniform Securities Act.
What does it mean in practice? Let's say I'm selling something completely exempt.
It means that even if a security is exempt from registration, like a pristine U.S. government bond, it is not exempt from anti-fraud provisions. If I blatantly lie to you while selling you a treasury bond, I have committed securities fraud. Even if it's a federal covered security where the state can't require registration, the state administrator still retains full, unmitigated anti-fraud authority to investigate you, subpoena you, and shut you down.
Let's break down the USA general anti-fraud provision. It has three specific prongs, and it applies to anyone. You don't have to be a registered broker or advisor to commit securities fraud. A regular person selling a security can commit fraud. It applies to offers, sales, A&E purchases. What are the three prongs?
Prong one, employing any device, scheme, or artifice to defraud. This requires intent. You sat in a room and planned a scheme. Prong two, making an untrue statement of a material fact or omitting a material fact necessary to make your statements not misleading. Prong three, engaging in any act, practice, or course of business that operates as a fraud or deceit upon any person.
Okay, here is the massive exam trap regarding those three prongs. Which of those prongs does not require intentional conduct?
Prong three, it does not require intent.
Explain the why there. How on earth can I commit fraud if I didn't mean to?
Because the law cares about the effect on the victim, not just what was in your heart. Look at the specific language, conduct, that operates as a fraud. If you are just bumbling around being incredibly negligent, failing to verify basic facts, and the result of your careless actions operates as a fraud on Ian the investor, you are guilty under prong three. You don't need to have twirled your mustache and planned a deliberate heist. The destructive effect is what matters.
That's a great distinction. Now, prong two mentions omitting a material fact. What is the standard for materiality? If Frank's dog socks cause a mild rash on one out of 100 dogs, does he have to disclose it? Is there a strict 5% formula? Or is it whatever the administrator randomly decides is material?
No, the legal standard is the reasonable investor test. Information is material if a reasonable investor would consider it important in making an investment decision. That's it. It's not a mathematical formula. Would a reasonable person care that Frank's dog socks cause mild rashes before investing 100 grand? Yes, because that could lead to lawsuits or product recalls. Therefore, it's material.
Now, contrast the general anti-fraud provision with the advisory anti-fraud provision.
The advisory provision is narrower in scope. It specifically targets people who receive consideration, meaning money, for advising on securities. Investment advisors and their representatives, they are held to a fiduciary standard.
And there is one specific rule in the advisory provision that gets tested constantly: principal trading. Let's set up a scenario. Let's say I am an investment advisor. I own 1,000 shares of Apple in my firm's own inventory. Ian is my advisory client. I genuinely think Ian should buy Apple stock. So instead of going with the open market, I sell my 1,000 shares directly to Ian from my own inventory. I acted as a principal in the trade. Is that allowed?
It is allowed, but it triggers incredibly strict disclosure and consent requirements. Because there is a massive inherent conflict of interest when an advisor sells their own property to a client, you might just be dumping your losing stocks onto them at a bad price. The law requires two things: written disclosure to the client of the capacity in which the advisor is acting, and affirmative client consent.
And when exactly must this happen?
Before completion of the transaction, not after. Not printed in fine print on the trade confirmation statement a week later. Before completion.
Exam trap time. Can I just have Ian sign a big 50-page blanket consent form when he opens the account on day one that says, "I agree to let you do principal trades whenever you want for the rest of my life"?
Absolutely not. Regulators hate that. Blanket consents at account opening do not work for principal trading. The disclosure and the consent must be per transaction. Every single time you do it, you have to get consent.
What if I call him on the phone, I tell him orally, "Hey, Ian, I'm selling this out of my own inventory," and he says, "Yeah, sure, whatever"?
Doesn't work. The rule explicitly states the disclosure must be written. Oral disclosure fails the test completely.
Written, prior, per transaction consent. Write that down. Okay, final topic before our recap. The administrator's powers. We know they can issue stop orders, they can investigate, they can subpoena. But what about revoking exemptions? Can the administrator just decide a security or a transaction is no longer exempt?
Yes, but only for certain exemptions. The administrator has the power to deny, suspend, or revoke the exemption for exchange-listed securities, nonprofit securities, employee benefit plans, and all exempt transactions.
Okay, so if Frank is relying on the limited offering exemption, which is an exempt transaction, the administrator can revoke that privilege if they suspect Frank is playing games. But what can they not revoke?
The administrator cannot revoke the exemption for government securities or bank securities.
Why not?
Because they are considered inherently exempt. The state administrator in Kansas cannot revoke the exemption for a United States Treasury bond issued by the federal government. That is completely beyond their jurisdictional power.
That makes total sense. All right, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. We have built Frank's empire, almost bankrupted him with Fiona, navigated the regulatory maze of state and federal rules, and dodged fraud charges. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the top testable takeaways from this deep dive. I'll hit you, you hit me. Number one, annuities.
Variable annuities are a security because the investor holds the investment risk. Fixed annuities are not a security because the insurance company holds the risk.
Number two, issuer versus non-issuer transactions.
It comes down to who gets the money. If the company gets the proceeds, it's an issuer transaction. If anyone else gets it, even the CEO selling his own personal shares to buy a yacht, it's a non-issuer transaction.
Number three, finders and compensation.
Finders who receive transaction-based compensation, a percentage fee, trigger broker-dealer registration. If an issuer uses them, the issuer loses their offering exemption, which gives all investors rescission rights, meaning they get their money back plus interest.
Number four, federal covered securities under Reg D and Reg A.
Big money equals federal covered. Reg D traditional and verified, rules 506B and 506C, and Reg A Tier 2, RE federal covered. Reg D small issue $10 and Reg A Tier 1, AE not.
Number five, the anti-fraud golden rule.
Fraud is never exempt. The administrator always has anti-fraud authority over everything, and Prom 3 does not require intent. It only requires that your conduct operates as a fraud on the victim.
Number six, principal trading for advisors.
Requires written prior per transaction consent. Blanket consents and oral disclosures do not count.
Incredible. If you've been listening, re-listen to that recap a few times before you walk into the exam room. Now, before we sign off, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought. Something to chew on during your next walk or commute.
This is something that isn't strictly in your textbook, but it builds on everything we just discussed, and it proves how dynamic these laws really are.
Exactly. We spent a lot of time on the Howey test today, specifically prong 4. The expectation of profits derives solely from the efforts of others. That's what makes Frank's dog sock investment contract a security, because Frank and his human management team are doing all the managerial work while Ian sits on the couch. But think about the future. What happens in 10 years when Frank retires and he hands over the entire dog sock company to an advanced AI, an autonomous AI that runs the factory, creates the marketing, manages the finances, and distributes the profits automatically based on code? There are no others doing the efforts anymore. There is just an algorithm. Does that mean the investment is no longer a security? Will the Supreme Court have to rewrite a law from 1946 to account for the age of artificial intelligence?
It's a fascinating legal gray area. Regulators are already wrestling with this in the crypto space with decentralized autonomous organizations, and they are going to have to face it on a much larger scale very soon.
Something to think about. Good luck on the exam. You've got this. We will see you on the next deep dive.